sexual abuse in the fields today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Sexual harassment, abuse, rape, all used to be problems among migrant workers in the tomato fields of Immokalee, Florida.
Now women speak out. When a woman feels safe to speak about the problems, the abuse can be stamped out because now the crew leaders and the abusers know there are consequences.
Plus, learning Yiddish to give voice to a forgotten poet.
That first year, working alone, I made my way through 3 or 4 poems. I could feel a heat under the words of the poetry, but at a great distance that my English couldn't touch.
Those stories, plus a scandal in professional British Scrabble. Juicy. That's worth 17 points. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It happened again today, another man accused of sexual harassment, and the list just keeps getting longer. All week we've been hearing about Roy Moore, the Republican Senate candidate in Alabama. Today it's Al Franken, sitting Democratic senator from Minnesota. A journalist has accused Franken of harassing her when they were both part of a USO tour to entertain American troops in the Middle East. Who knows who will be next? And while many of us are watching this great unmasking of 2017 with astonishment, one group of women in Florida are just shaking their heads. They're agricultural workers, tomato pickers, who got tired of being abused, so they found a solution. Tipa Fernandez reports.
In the mid-90s, when Catalina was 15, she left Mexico with some friends in search of a better life. They ended up in Immokalee, Florida, and the teens were thrilled to find work right away in the tomato fields. They worked very hard for little pay. But the hardest part, Catalina says, was the constant sexual harassment they endured. As soon as she could, she left that farm, figuring she'd left behind the abuse. The next places she worked were no better.
It was hard because in this field, the harassment was more overt, more personal. The man who did it was more open about it. He tried to touch us. He said sexual things.
Catalina says many women were targeted, and she began to feel it was just how the fields were. Their work out there was supervised by men, who probably some years before had been pickers just like them, but they'd risen in the ranks. These men were also in charge of transporting the pickers from a central location in town to the fields. In essence, these guys, called troqueros, were the ones with the power to decide who worked the fields on any given day. Catalina says after about 10 years as a picker, this one particular troquero fixated on her and her friend.
It wasn't easy. He would get into the truck and touch us, and we would say no. And then one day he called me and told me to come to him because he had something to show me. He was the boss, the one who would give us work, so I went. And he was showing me some accounts that I didn't understand why he was showing it to me, right? And then he says he likes me a lot and he wants to have a relationship with me. And I told him no, that I wasn't looking for a relationship right now, that all I wanted to do was work and not have any problems, especially because he's a married man. He told me I wouldn't have any problems, that he would take care of everything, he'd pay my rent. And I told him all I wanted to do was work. Then he grabbed my hand and pulled me to him to touch him. I yanked it back, my hand. I felt bad. Sad. I wondered, why is this happening? All I need to do is work.
After she refused his advances, he told her she no longer had work there. That's the kind of harsh repercussion many women who refused the sexual advances of supervisors faced in the fields over the years, says Lupe Gonzalo, also a tomato picker in Immokalee for years.
Many times it was the crew leaders who did the harassment.
Gonzalo watched this happen to so many women. The problem was endemic across all the fields, she says.
It's that women don't know that by law they have rights, that here sexual harassment is something punishable by law. Women didn't know this.
In the 90s, the one hope women had was an organization, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW. They helped women file complaints. Gonzalo now works here as an educator, passing on info to pickers about their rights. She said that CIW members reached a point where they realized fighting cases one-on-one didn't do much to stop the widespread abuses. So women pickers at CIW decided to make stamping out sexual abuse a major part of the campaign. They were fighting for other things, like better wages and work conditions. And this is when things really changed. It's a Sunday evening in early November, and the town of Immokalee is mostly shut down, except for the laughter and marimba tinkering coming out of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers building. The Harvey Weinstein scandal has the women talking. How is it these women with so much more money and status than them are still experiencing this harassment when these tomato pickers who earn minimum wage in backbreaking work have stamped it out? Is the essence of the hushed conversation. Gonzalo gives me the recap.
See, it's a problem we have eliminated. Now women speak out. When a woman feels safe to speak about the problems, the abuse can be stamped out because now the crew leaders and the abusers know there are consequences.
As I talk with women farm workers, they all say, without question, that in the past, sexual abuse was a constant problem. But now, they no longer experience it. So what did they do to stamp it out?
Real world sanctions, actual effects of violating this behavior.
Susan Marcus is the dean of the Padu Rand Graduate School, and she's been studying what pickers and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have done in Florida. She says they honed in on one key point, something we tell our toddlers. There must be consequences for behavior that crosses the line, and it must be swift and visible to all. So the Immokalee workers fought to have the complaint system written into their labour agreement, the Fair Food Program. And they added this small but hugely significant detail, an independent body to be the arbiter, Marcus says.
Most violations take 2 or 3 days to investigate, but it's responding quickly, investigating thoroughly, and then having real-world sanctions. In the case of the farm workers, it's the growers losing market share.
Okay, let me explain. See, this labor agreement signed by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in 2011, the Fair Food Program, brought large tomato farms on board with the new standards. One way they did this was to simultaneously convince the biggest purchasers in the country, think McDonald's, Walmart, Whole Foods, to only buy produce from fields that were part of the Fair Food Program, which basically meant they were treating their workers justly. If a farm owner doesn't take action against one of its sexually abusive supervisors, instant consequence. They won't be in the Fair Food Program, and the market for their tomatoes, well, disappears.
We're not talking about, like, gee, we're doing something extra for our folks.
Jonas Forms is the co-CEO of one of Florida's largest growers, Sunripe Certified Brands. He says, yes, there is a bottom line incentive for CEOs to make sure their managers don't abuse their power. But he says it's also just the right thing to do.
I'm not doing anything extra for our folks. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing in accordance with the law and our own company ethics and morality.
He employs thousands of immigrants to work in his fields. And with the Fair Food Program, this means his company pays a living wage, provides better working conditions like good bathrooms and shaded areas for break time, and they use the hours when workers are on the clock to do mandatory sexual harassment trainings. This is from their training video. It's a reenactment of what women experienced.
Vamos, María, ven, súbete a mi troca, María.
No, gracias, no.
Ven, María, ven.
No, gracias, no tengo interés.
We don't use the word, it's no longer acceptable behavior. We don't talk about it in those terms. We talk about it in terms of criminal behavior that will not be tolerated, and we will go after you.
The Fair Food Program covers about 35,000 workers in the tomato fields in Florida. It's not nationwide yet, nor does it extend to other crops. Lupe Gonzalo says the Coalition for Immokalee Workers is trying to change that. And while they work on that, she thinks some of Hollywood's women, or even us in the public radio world, well, we should take a leaf from the book of Florida's tomato pickers.
Just look at what we, women who have basically no opportunities, right? Look at how we built this program. I think working together is the only way to change these things that are happening.
For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Immokalee, Florida.
In recent years, we've sadly become used to cheating scandals in big league sports, doped athletes, faked drug tests, disappointed fans. But now unsportsmanlike behavior has been detected in a more gentlemanly pursuit, British competitive Scrabble. Our London reporter Leo Hornack has been lining up his vowels. Tell us what happened, Leo.
Well, Marco, there's something quite Shakespearean about this story. Alan Simmons was one of the most respected and powerful players in British Scrabble. He was number 5 ranking in the world. He'd written numerous books on the game. He was even the Times of London's Scrabble correspondent. I was surprised to find there was such a thing. And last year, rumours began to spread that he was doing something pretty unthinkable. According to several different accounts, he was picking tiles from the tile bag. If you remember, if you haven't played Scrabble for a while.
I'm a regular, so I know what you're talking about.
Right. Well, at the beginning of each turn, you take new tiles from the tile bag.
Right.
And in this case, he was spotted picking tiles, looking at them, and then illegally returning them to the bag to choose better ones, double dipping. Basically, he was cheating, which is, I counted, it's a 13-point word, actually, that if you don't hit a double word score.
How has the rest of the Scrabble community over there reacted to this?
I think it's shock, really, Marco. It's shock and kind of embarrassment that, you know, one of their great heroes and champions has been laid low in this way. But what's interesting is Alan himself's reaction. He is banned for 3 years as a result of this, but he's said that he's not going to contest the ruling and that he's just going to focus on things that are more important than Scrabble.
So I often kind of jot down good Scrabble words when I come across them. Since you seem to be slightly geekier than I am on this, Leo, any Scrabble tips for me?
Well, actually, I've got a little quiz for you, Marco. For real Scrabble cheats, there's a special online Scrabble definition generation engine. In other words, if you come up with a word that would be useful to play but doesn't really exist, it will provide a fake definition.
Right, and so if nobody challenges you, you can get away with it, right?
Exactly. So I've got a little quiz for you, Marco. I've got a selection of words, which some of them are from the 2010 winning game at the British Scrabble Championship, and some of them are definitely not. They are made-up words.
All right, hit me.
Okay. Seredia. Organs of reproduction in lichen. Seredia.
Seredia. That sounds real.
Correct. That was in the 2010 championship winning game.
All right, one for one.
Quitnub. That's a noun. It's a large, moose-like, subterranean celestial entity reported by travelers since antiquity.
All right, Quitnub. That's totally fake.
Yeah, that is fake.
Oh, yes. Two for two.
Marco Warman. Marco Warman. All one word. Noun. Antiquated. A mermaid of the first order having 7 swords. Mermaid of the first order having 7 swords.
And it's Marco Warman? That's the word?
That's the word.
I'm sorry, I have to say fake.
Yeah, how did you guess that one?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
That's fake. Yeah, that is fake.
Our London reporter, Leo Hornack, here's my Scrabble tip, a pocket full of blank tiles. That's all I'm going to say.
That is devious. That will get you thrown straight out of the Champions Association.
Our man in London and a Scrabble fanatic, Leo Hornack, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Just ahead, a Yiddish poet is rediscovered. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The poet Celia Dropkin wrote in Yiddish. That's a big reason why most of us don't know about her. But Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words, knows all about Celia Dropkin. You don't speak Yiddish, do you, Patrick?
Not even abyssal.
Abyssal? Well, thanks. Tell me what abyssal means.
I had to look it up a little bit.
All right, that's useful. One more for my vocabulary.
Okay, but here is someone who does know a lot of Yiddish, and that is Jennifer Kronovit. She's an American poet who studied Yiddish just for one reason, and that was to translate 20th century Yiddish poetry. There happens to be a ton of it, untranslated, written by poets who were living in New York City.
And Celia Dropkin was one of those poets?
That's right. Yeah, she was born in 1887 in what today is Belarus. Then it was part of the Russian Empire. Her family was involved in a Jewish socialist group, and she ended up fleeing to the U.S. when she was 25. As a poet, she didn't get much respect. She was a woman writing in a man's world, and the poems themselves that she wrote, they were often dismissed as florid and overly sexualized.
So you told us about Jennifer Kronovit. How did she come across Dropkin's poems?
Well, it was in Yiddish class in New York, and she was learning her Yiddish, and she was taking this translation exercise, and these poems were placed in front of her. And it was also in this class that Jennifer met two other students who would go on to become her co-translators. This was about 15 years ago. Let's pick up the story with Jennifer introducing those two other students. Their names are Faith Jones and Sam Solomon.
Back then, Sam was a teenager.
I was still at high school. I had one more year coming along.
And Faith was a librarian for the New York Public Library.
I turned 35 that summer.
There was a decade between each of us, and I was in the middle. We didn't know each other very well, and certainly wouldn't have guessed how long we'd work together on this one project and what it would come to mean to us. That next summer, I moved back to New York and took another intensive Yiddish course. Upon regrouping, and with my Yiddish slightly better than before, Sam, Faith, and I made a more realistic plan. We would get together every few weeks to go over a handful of poems. I started to settle into my adult life. I had a job, my writing, a boyfriend, and I had Sam, Faith, and Celia. We usually met at Faith's apartment. She was older, and her life was more stable than mine. A model for a life I hoped I could have. She and her wife lived in a cozy apartment in Brooklyn, and they'd created a community around themselves of friends who cared about books and Yiddish.
I think I turned into mom.
Faith always reminded us to take breaks, to eat her delicious and hearty snacks, because the brain, too, is a muscle.
I'm not good when I'm hungry, so I guess that turned into one of my recurring roles, or maybe it was a recurring joke, I'm not sure.
As a librarian, she also made sure that a bevy of dictionaries was in easy reach. Snacks and dictionaries, a perfect combination. In fact, I would say that if anyone is going to undertake a long project with someone, choose a librarian. Faith kept track of everything, of what we did know and, more importantly, what we didn't. She was our detective, finding words we couldn't define, hiding out in other languages, and finding people to help us hiding out across North America. She reached out to Dropkin's family to let them know that we cared about Dropkin's work. At one point, Faith organized a visit to one of Celia's sons, John.
And it turned out that he lived a few blocks from me in Brooklyn.
He was in his 90s. My mother, he said with great pride and a hint of deviousness, was a true bohemian.
Dropkin wrote these erotic poems and poems that were very ambivalent about motherhood. And he found none of those things odd or off-putting.
I'd never heard anyone talk about their mother that way. Sam had grown up going to Yiddish classes as a child and was born into a Yiddish culture in New York I had thought was gone and buried.
And I was interested in poetry. I was in sort of high school literary magazine and wrote and did things like that.
Sam saw Yiddish as a living language, and so he approached Dropkin's poems with an openness to all that life can offer.
I was really excited by them.
Sam, as a high school student, and then as a college student, and then as a graduate student, didn't come to Dropkin with a limiting imagination of who Dropkin should be. He was thrilled by who she was. Through the years of translating Dropkin, Sam was the one who argued most passionately to stay true to Dropkin's Yiddish.
Because her Yiddish is very spare. It's not especially full of jokey idioms or things that people associate with Yiddish in America.
Mein Mame, a 22-jährige, an Almone mit zwei kleinen Kinder geblieben.
As close as Sam and Faith and I grew through our work, I still kept a distance between me and Dropkin. I was afraid to touch the poems too closely. They were so over the top. In them, a mother's lust spurts out of the daughter.
Jetzt spritz von mir offen mein Mames heißer, heiliger, tief verbehaltener Bagger.
A woman becomes impregnated with her own lover.
Du hast nicht verseht ein Kind in mir, nor hast verseht sich allein.
A woman breastfeeds her lover.
Still dein Hunger, dein Durst auf mein Brust.
sucks her lover's blood, is devoured by the fat worm of passion. A mother lets her daughter cry in the distance as she tries to ignore the wails.
Mich hat dort gerufen, mein kleines Kind.
I was afraid that Dropkin would infect my own poetry with drama. Deep down, I wondered if I was wasting my time trying to translate a writer who, at best, wrote the poetic equivalent of schmaltzy, trashy romance novels, and that no matter how hard we worked, we would never be able to make this poetry palatable to today's readers in English. Despite my misgivings about Dropkin, I kept working.
Welcome, welcome, my guest. Lay down the burden of your life. Undress, rest.
I owed it to Sam and Faith, and I also couldn't imagine stepping away from what had become a wonderful part of my life.
Sate your hunger, your thirst, at my breast, at my breast.
In 2005, we finished rough translations of every single poem that Celia Dropkin had ever written, and then we put her away. Faith moved back to her native Canada, Sam moved to California and then to England as a professor. I moved to China and back. I got married, I published my first book of poetry, and then I had a son. One night, for the first time in 5 years, I opened up our old Dropkin files.
My lithe body barely touching the blades.
I read the poems again, and they felt completely new to me. The over-the-top personal images were still there, of course. But now, instead of being turned off by them, I recognized myself. Dropkin took familiar images for love, for sex, for motherhood, the same images I felt stuck inside as a writer, and she pushed them to the extreme.
I'm tired of dancing between you, cold steel daggers. I want my blood warming your bare tips to fall.
The results were the chaotic, lustful, disappointed, terrifying, and thrilling thoughts of a mother like me.
Jennifer Cronovit. There's much more on Jennifer and Celia Dropkin in the latest World in Words podcast, including audio of Dropkin reciting one of her poems. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts or at pri.org/language. Patrick Cox of the World in Words. Always great to see you. Thanks.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, climate researcher Elizabeth Holland.
I grew up in New Mexico, so I came from the desert. I first saw the ocean when I was 16.
Now she lives in Fiji, fighting the effects of climate change.
We have a third of our communities will need to be moved. The social dimensions of that are huge.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Have you seen the water bottle video yet? President Trump's press conference yesterday, recapping his two-week trip to Asia, it's been getting a lot of attention, and not only for the reasons the Trump administration intended. In a clip that's gone viral, the president fumbles to find some water. Then he picks up a water bottle with a label familiar to many of us, Fiji.
When I talk to big audiences about water, I always ask, how many people in the room think the water in the bottle is really from Fiji? And almost no one ever thinks the water really comes from Fiji.
Aha, but it does. That was Charles Fishman. He's the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. We reached him to find out more about how the product in that bottle impacts Fiji's economy and the environment.
You know, my impression of Fiji water when I got to Fiji was much different than the impression you would have trying to understand it from back here in the United States, where we're the largest market by far. In America, Fiji water is a little bit of a ridiculous product. No one ever needs it. It's a pure indulgence. But in Fiji, it has a tremendous economic impact. Fiji water alone is the number one export from the country by dollar value, almost twice as much as any other export.
And if it's so important to Fiji's economy, are the profits going back to, like, the people who need it?
I think that's a mix, of course. The company's owned by the Resnick family, which is a California agriculture family. They bought it from the original founder And I suspect that most of the profits come back here to the United States. But in Fiji, you know, they do conservation work. They do help bring water to Fijians. They try and spark entrepreneurial efforts.
So what about the company's environmental track record? What can you tell us about that?
You know, you can't help but pick up this pristine bottle of water. They actually bottle the water in Fiji. They pack it in plastic and shrink wrap and cardboard and put it in a shipping container and then send it all the way around the world. It comes with this ridiculous contrail of sort of carbon impact and carbon pollution, precisely because the people who can afford to buy Fiji water have water coming out of taps in their homes.
Is the water flown from Fiji or shipped by boat? Is the company at least trying to limit the impact?
Yes. Even we Americans couldn't afford Fiji water if it came in cargo airplanes. No, it comes on ships. But, you know, ships are also hugely polluting, and it's a high-intensity factory that's – so there's certainly impact there. They claim that they offset 120% of their carbon impact. They claim to be carbon negative. That's a claim they have not reasserted in the last few years. And in fact, when you go to their website, they themselves don't address the question of the carbon impact of the product at all. So they seem like they have sort of given up fighting that fight.
The founder of the company, Fiji Water, he got a 99-year lease on the source in Fiji. Did the new owners pick up that lease as well?
Yeah, they got the lease with the purchase.
Does that suggest that this is going to be kind of the status quo in Fiji for like the next century?
Well, yes and no. The Resniks have a huge investment in terms of the equipment, the training, but Fiji has a little bit of a history of political tumult. And so it does depend a little bit on what happens with the government in Fiji.
Charles, what do you drink water-wise? What's your potable water plan?
I have a glass of water on my desk right now with ice in it, and the ice and the water are tap water. I'm a tap water guy, but there are members of my family who love Fiji water.
Do they tell you what they like about it?
They like the way it tastes, and there's no difference in taste between Fiji water and lots of other waters. If you set up a blind taste test, even the senior executives of Fiji water wouldn't be able to pick their own water out of five glasses of water in the same glass at the same temperature. And that's the whole point. The carbonated waters aside, all of these waters are selling an experience at the moment that you're thirsty and a kind of a branding and an image. And we Americans, some of us Americans are willing to buy it. Bottled water sales in the United States are at an all-time high. They have never been higher. So all the campaigns against bottled water aren't having that big an impact.
Charles Fishman is the author of The Big Thirst. Kind of hard to miss the layers of irony in that story. All that pollution from shipping water from Fiji could well be contributing to the rising sea levels that are threatening to flood Fiji. Here's a story now about someone who's gone to Fiji to try to help solve that very problem. From our Livable Planet desk, here's reporter Sonia Narang.
When I walk into Elizabeth Holland's office, it looks like a museum. There are big traditional fans, wooden canoe replicas, a handmade Fijian cloth with a turtle design, all artifacts from her life here in the Pacific Islands. But she grew up far from here.
I grew up in New Mexico, so I came from the desert. And I first saw the ocean when I was 16.
These days, the ocean is central to her work as director of the climate change program here at the University of the South Pacific. She once devoted herself to research on the Earth's atmosphere, but these days, Holland is more focused on helping communities cope with extreme weather and rising seas.
We have a third of our communities will need to be moved. The social dimensions of that are huge.
And what Holland brings to the table is her science. Last year, when Cyclone Winston roared through, she went straight to work trying to forecast the storm surge.
I'm always very obsessive about finding every source of information I can. And because of my background, that meant that I could help translate it and get it back out to make sure that we had the best forecast information available, that people were taking precautions. There were whole schools that moved because My students read my posts on Facebook.
When she's not battling emergencies, she's heading up a program to develop climate change action plans for communities throughout the Pacific Islands. A big part of that is combining scientific and local knowledge. And she teaches basic climate science to students who often go on to key jobs in the region.
I think it gives me the basics on understanding climate change and climate science. For me to be able to make a change within my country, I need to know these basics.
Andi Davila Litiana Talemaimalea is a current student of Hollands.
She's definitely an inspiration. She makes me sort of think out of the box. She's definitely a climate warrior, and she's definitely someone I would like to become and try to emulate.
Holland was on the team of scientists who won the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for their climate work. But her transformation to climate warrior came a few years earlier. She was still living in the U.S. at the time.
Friends of mine, three families, were skiing in the backcountry of Colorado on a snowpack that could only happen with climate change. And one of my friends was killed, and the whole rest of the party was traumatized in some way.
Holland says she couldn't deny the connection between climate change, that snowpack, and the death of her friend. There had been a series of unusual freeze-thaw cycles that made the snowpack extremely unstable.
And I knew then that I needed to be able to do something.
She decided to work hand-in-hand with communities on climate resilience instead of just doing the science. She began supporting indigenous groups that are often left out of climate change discussions, including Native American tribes in the U.S.
Very often, those who are facing climate change, who are at the front lines of climate change, don't have a voice. And they don't have a voice in the science.
Her desire to change that is what ultimately led Holland to upend her life in Colorado and move halfway around the world to Fiji.
The team got together this morning, and they came out early, and we took Cove for a paddle.
On a recent Saturday, she chats with students and colleagues during a lunch break from a climate change seminar with visiting scientists.
For me, it's making it even clearer what a wrong-headed decision it was.
They've seen this prominent American scientist slowly transform as she embraces her new life in Fiji. When she speaks now, she speaks on behalf of Pacific Islanders. This week, she's representing the region at the UN Climate Change Summit in Bonn.
You can tell that her heart is here in the Pacific, and she fights very hard for the Pacific Islands.
Tammy Tabe is a fellow climate change lecturer.
Despite her being an American, I think her standing together with the Pacific Islands during these negotiations really has a greater impact.
Holland herself hopes some Pacific-style diplomacy might rub off on world leaders at the summit.
American culture is very direct, and people, if they want something, they ask for it directly. The Pacific, because people spend much more time thinking about how all of the connections work, they may be much, much more successful.
Holland certainly spends plenty of time forging those connections herself. At the climate change event on campus, she mixes right in with her purple Fijian dress, then goes to the end of the line for a plate of traditional Fijian food. For the World, Sonia Narang, Suva, Fiji.
Sonia's reporting in Fiji was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. Here's another Fiji connection. A Fijian song called Ko Loma Loma. If Fiji water is the height of commercialism, these singers are the opposite. A group of people from one place in Fiji, Vuna Village, who create community in part by getting together and singing a cappella. The song Ko Loma Loma reflects on the natural beauty of the Loma Loma Harbor. In Fiji, it's a classic. Loma Loma, courtesy of the Future Folk Partnership with Smithsonian's Folklife Festival.
And the money, and the money.
Wow, great harmonies there from Fiji. So yesterday on the show, we brought you the story of two Rohingya refugees who fled the violence in Myanmar and made it here to Boston. Many, though, are not so lucky. In fact, thousands of refugees are still trying to cross the border between Myanmar and Bangladesh to reach sprawling refugee camps on the Bangladeshi side. Here's more from my BBC colleague, Justin Rowlatt.
What you can hear is the voices of about 60 people on a homemade raft, plastic containers lashed together with rope. A single wave could have torn it apart, yet these rafts now arrive virtually every day. They paddle in to land. As they struggle ashore, the young help the old, parents cradle babies, and they all tell the same now familiar stories of violence and horror. They kept us on that beach for a month and a half, says one woman. We had so little food. The army shot my husband, blinding him in one eye. In a children's health centre, they checked the condition of new arrivals in the camp. Noor is 2.5, but looks much younger. She's severely malnourished. Without nutritious food, her development could be affected for life.
Can you just show me?
Michael Dunford runs the massive World Food Programme operation in the camps.
1 in 4 children are malnourished. We actually expect this situation to deteriorate before it improves. We have a nutrition crisis here now.
Hundreds of people are queuing for food at one of dozens of feeding stations in what they are now calling the mega camp. All they get is the most basic nutrition, rice, lentils and a little oil, enough to keep them alive. Things are getting more orderly. Teams are building new roads and bridges. Thousands of toilets have been dug here in just the last few weeks. But the truth is, this is basically a giant open-air prison. Soldiers now guard all the roads out of the camp. Refugees aren't allowed to leave. The soldiers stop two Rohingya women, as one officer explains.
We have shown them mercy and brought them to our country. Now they are trying to invade.
The Rohingya can't go back to Myanmar. Despite all the evidence of atrocities, this week the Myanmar government issued a report that exonerated the army from blame.
The BBC's Justin Rowlatt reporting there from the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar. American trophy hunters have something to celebrate. The Trump administration says it's lifting a ban on elephant trophies being imported into the U.S. from Zambia and Zimbabwe. In other words, American hunters can bring home the heads and feet of endangered elephants that they've killed. The administration says the move will actually help elephant conservation efforts. If that leaves you scratching your head, listen to this.
You can just pick whatever animal you want from the menu that they offer you, see the price, and book the kill.
Big cats in 21 and 22, sold!
And that money will all go back into conservation.
How much for that sucker?
This is my trophy, and there's not any bureaucrat that can take it away from me.
That's from the trailer for Trophy, a documentary that came out this year about big game hunting in Africa. Shaul Schwartz directed it with Christina Klawisch. Schwartz says making the film led him to reconsider his assumptions.
Basically, you know, we sit in the U.S. or in the West and kind of say, well, of course we should look out for lions and elephants, let's say. And then you get to Africa and you understand that they don't like living with lions. Lions eat their cows and sheep. Elephants are the bulldozer of nature. They destroy crops. They're also a potential to be a lot of meat. And on worst case scenario, they're a potential to be poached to make a lot of money. So it very quickly flips on you that if we want to solve this problem, we have to start looking into what the locals need and in their how they see it. And their relationship to these animals, which are majestic, and we see them as majestic, is quite different than you would think. They basically need a reason to look after it. Now, in some places, that reason is tourism. And right. That's a fantastic reason. It brings a lot of money And it works extremely well to create benefits from this majestic treasure they own, so to speak. However, tourism is really effective in about 2 to 4% of the continent. And that's where hunting can play a positive role. It can also play a negative role.
You actually met a lot of hunters making this film, Trophy. I'd like us to hear from one of them. This is Philip Glass. He's a farmer in Texas and a hunter.
When I was a little boy, I remember I had a BB gun. I can vividly remember my mother telling me, you can go shoot birds, but don't shoot a red bird. And what did I do? I went and shot a red bird. And I can still remember holding that bird in my hands and looking at its beak and just seeing how beautiful it was and how it was made. Right there in that moment, I realized that there is no way I could have loved that bird anymore, even though it was dead. And I think a lot of us as trophy hunters feel the same way. We just want that experience to go and hunt that animal one time. We'd really just want one.
Shaul, that's pretty intense. What do you make of Philip Glass's explanation? We just want one.
He said all that, and it happened to be the next day where he would shoot an elephant.
Wow.
And he does see himself as a big conservationist, which was something we were trying to understand. And early on, certainly when he originally told me the story, I couldn't look past why would anybody take joy in chasing and eventually killing an elephant, a lion, or whatever it is they're looking to put on their wall. It couldn't do it. But as the movie evolved, we tried to stop paying attention to this psychology and started to think, is the point they're trying to make, does it sometimes work? And I have to say about Philip Glass, he does research the places he goes to. He does want to go to places where he feels that the numbers and quotas are kept well, where hunting is done ethically and properly to his beliefs of what that is. You know, I can never understand why Philip wants to do it on a psychological level. I much more am conflicted about what that actually does on the conservation level.
So now with this news of the Trump administration deciding to reverse his ban on importing trophies from elephant hunts in Zimbabwe, I mean, what do you make of that?
When you encourage communities and give them value for those elephants, they will see poachers as thieves and they will want to work with anti-poachers. Now, the problem is there is a lot of corruption and a lot of this goes wrong. But I would be very careful to kind of do a carte blanche on this subject and say this is always wrong. Elephants are endangered, so we should never shoot one. Where I was in northern Zimbabwe, I think I saw hunting used beneficially. And in fact, I think if you were to completely ban hunting, I think it will fall apart and we will see these animals disappear. I've seen the reverse. I've seen places where hunting has decimated whole species because the quotas weren't kept or because there was overhunting. So I think what I'm urging is to be specific, not to just listen to the heart and scream bloody murder.
Shaul Schwartz co-directed the film Trophy about big game hunting in Africa, along with Christina Klawisch. Finally, a preview of a special edition of the show tomorrow. Next time on The World, we're going to spend the entire hour exploring gun culture around the globe. So not just America, although to be fair, our starting point is America and the serious problem our country has with mass shootings. We'll be hearing from Adam Langford, a professor at the University of Alabama. He studies where the U.S. stands globally when it comes to mass shootings.
There was a sense that America had more mass shootings than other countries. But nobody really knew how many more, if it is true that we have more.
Not surprisingly, we do have more mass shootings here. Tomorrow, Langford explains the data he relied on and how he used it to reach that conclusion, and also what he found as to why.
It's not that we have higher homicide rates. Certainly there are countries that are more dangerous than us. It's not about wealth. It's not about urbanization. It's not about suicide rates. The difference between us and other countries that explains why we have more of these attackers was firearm ownership rate. In other words, firearms per capita.
But here's the thing. Americans are not alone by any means in loving guns. Number two on the list of countries with most guns per capita, Yemen. And there we'll hear how gun ownership is tied up with cultural notions of masculinity. Also, what it's like to go shopping for guns in Yemen.
The majority of the shops are selling firearms, everything from pistols to automatic weapons to RPGs. I saw tank shells, and I'm told if you ask the right person, you could get a tank itself.
We'll also hear from Israel, where gun laws have changed over time, and not always in ways you might expect, and from El Salvador, a nation seemingly awash in weapons.
You can't go anywhere. I mean, you can't turn your nose without running into somebody with a gun. You go to McDonald's, there's somebody with a gun. You know, walking down the street, you go to the beach, and it's like, really, you know, you're wearing trunks. What's the deal? Why do you need a gun out here on the sand?
All that and much, much more coming up tomorrow on a special edition of The World focused entirely on gun culture around the globe and what lessons other nations might have for us about reducing gun violence here. We hope you'll join us for that. Again, that's tomorrow right here on The World. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.